Prior to serving at First Baptist Church Austin, I did have the privilege of serving at Northminster Baptist in Jackson, Mississippi, which is an honor I share with Dr. Brewer. He will agree when I say that this is a highly affluent, influential congregation whose influence was beyond what I ever anticipated. I learned that through an experience there. During my second year in Jackson, I was invited for a week of preaching at Wilton Baptist Church in Wilton, Connecticut. And some of my members of my church in Jackson found out I was going and called me and said, "Listen, we want you to go early and stay in New York and see a Broadway show on us. Just tell us which one you want to go to." Oh, what an offer. Well, Miss Saigon was opening, and so was Will Rogers Follies. You probably never heard of either one of them. It's been so long ago now. They were both just opening, and being an Okie, I decided I wanted to go hear good old Will Rogers again. "Fine," they said, "your ticket will be at Will Call." So I arrived early, and there was a lot of press outside the theater, and I thought it was because the show was fairly new. And so I went to Will Call to get my ticket, and there was my ticket, and it said Row A, Seat 1. I mean, this is fantastic. Row A, Seat 1. And when I went inside, I discovered that that was even better than I anticipated. That you had a regular theater, of course, but then on the left side of the theater, you had elevated seating that curved into the stage, and you had four rows with five beautiful chairs set up on that elevated seating. And that's where I was seated. Row A, Seat 1 was almost on stage. The show is about the Ziegfeld Follies and Will Rogers' part in the Follies, and as you can imagine, there were a lot of feather boas being used in the Ziegfeld Follies play, and I was so close that I had a lap full of feathers by the time the show was over. When I went to my seat, no one was on my row, and no one was on the row behind me, and every other seat in the theater was full. And then just before the curtain went up, in walked four people. Mary Hart from Entertainment Tonight with her husband, and Paula Zahn, who's now with MSNBC, but in those days was on the CBS Morning Show, and her husband. And they sat on my row. Mary Hart sat right next to me. And then the row behind was still empty, but just as the curtain rose, in walked Donald Trump and his girlfriend of that moment, who was Marla Maples, and three big bodyguards. I'm in row A, seat 1, and the Donald is in row B, seat 1. I have a better seat than Donald Trump. And that's when I began to respect my church members back in Jackson, Mississippi. You could see the people in the theater trying to figure out who was there, and now I understood the press outside. They were waiting for the Donald to arrive, and they were thinking, that's Donald Trump, and that's his newest exotic girlfriend, Marla Maples, and that's Mary Hart, and Paula Zahn, and who is that big, overweight, gray-headed guy sitting there? He must be a character actor of some kind. And how did he get the best seat in the house? Well, as the intermission drew close, I began to kind of get nervous. What if Mary Hart spoke to me? What was I going to say? I mean, I did not want to look like a fool. And sure enough, the lights came up, and Mary Hart, being the interviewer that she is, she wheeled to my right, to her right, and she says, stuck out her hand, she says, "Hi, I'm Mary Hart. Who are you?" And I thought to myself, I'm nobody. I'm not even a person. I don't exist. I have no reason to be here. I'm not sure how I got this seat. I'm sorry for taking this seat. I'm sure one of your friends wanted to be here this evening in this seat. Please forgive me for breathing. I didn't say all those things. But that's the question, isn't it? Even though my days in seminary are so very different from yours, I suspect you still ask some of the same questions of who am I and why am I here and what will I do with my life and where will I serve and what will the shape of that service be and what is God going to do and is this where I'm supposed to be and what is my identity in all this? The world is quick to tell us who we are. We are quick to put a lot of identities on ourselves. We are students, or we are lawyers, or we are a mom, or we are a wife, or a husband, we are a son, a daughter, we are black, brown, Asian, we are Catholic, Protestant, Jew, Muslim, we are, fill in the blank. And all those are helpful, but they do not tell the whole story of who we are. I am white. I am a Baptist. I am male. I am educated. I'm an Okie. I'm a pastor. I'm married. I'm a father. And all of those are modifiers that tell significant things about me, but they don't tell the whole story. I am white, but my mother was a Cherokee Indian, so I'm more than just white. I am Baptist, but my father's family was Quaker. And some of those people left and became Methodist when they couldn't find a friends group in Oklahoma. Imagine that. I'm from Oklahoma, but my family is from Indiana and England and Germany and North Carolina Cherokee territory. I'm educated, but as Stan Campbell used to say in the history department here at Baylor, the first understanding about being educated is realizing how little you really know. So my 27 and 25-year-old children know far more about information and computers and data and the ways of the world than I do. I am male, but we all contain both X and Y chromosomes. I am a pastor, but God help me if that is all I am. I am married, but I was not married at one time. If I am not first a person and a person in Christ, long before I wear any other identity, I won't really know who I am. No modifiers fully define, nor should they. What does define is the story of faith. The story of faith takes into itself our stories and gives us back an identity. It tells us who and whose we are. That's what we hear in these incredibly rich texts that the students read so well. The writer of Deuteronomy tells the story of the children of Israel being directed by Moses to, quote, observe the work of remembering when you enter the land called promise. So he says, when you harvest your newly settled land, take the first fruits of the ground and offer them to God. And he adds, as you do this, as you offer the best of what you have, don't forget to tell this story. A wandering Aramean was my ancestor. He went down into Egypt and lived there as an alien, few in number. And there became a great nation, mighty and populous. Every church I know has made this a Pledge Sunday text for our stewardship campaigns to satisfy the demands of the budget. Look at what we've done in this text. This isn't a stewardship campaign text. It can be used that way, I guess. This is an identity text. You give the first fruits as a sign of thanksgiving for who you are, as a sign of remembering whose you are. And what God and what the story of faith is doing in your life. And you tell the story. And you keep telling the story. Because the greatest, most important word maybe in the Old Testament is remember, remember, remember. And why? Because they always suffered from spiritual amnesia just like we do. Who and whose you are. Each person who in the community tells the story. And as they do, they find a powerful new understanding of the story for themselves. So even the youngest will say, that's me. I'm part of that great nation. I cried out to the Lord when the Egyptians oppressed. The Lord heard my voice. The Lord brought me out of Egypt. And here I am in this land offering my thanksgiving. And then the gospel companion to this piece is found in the 40 days that Jesus spent in the wilderness. It's what we know as the temptation narrative, and it stands alone as a powerful picture of Jesus clarifying his mission, his purpose, his identity, and I'll look at it more closely in just a moment. But first, it seems to me to be a part of what I would call an identity triptych of Jesus' identity. A triptych, of course, is a painting or a wood carving done in three panels so you can get the complete picture that the artist had in mind. And I think that's what Luke is doing here. I think Luke is giving us a triptych here that begins with the first panel being Jesus' baptism. Why was Jesus there at the river that day? Have we ever been able to answer that one? Not really. Was he there for cleansing from sin? Well, we've said no to that. Was he there to fulfill a Jewish law of cleansing, like a mikveh, maybe? Was he there to become president of a Baptist university? I don't know. Pardon me. I would suggest that one possible way of understanding this is that the time of preparation is over and the time of action is here. And the response he's making is to submit oneself to a new identity. And the response he hears is a word of blessing from God. "This is my son in whom I take great delight," says one translation. This is the word of blessing and identity. Everything he does out of this profound confidence that comes from knowing he is God's beloved child and that in him God takes great delight. And then if you'll notice in Luke, it's followed by Luke's genealogy. And here he lists all the grandmothers and grandfathers of the faith as if to say, this is a part of who you are, but you have more work to do than just to claim your identity based on your lineage, on your modifiers. Your identity precedes lineage. Your identity is tied up with God. He is the one who sent you. He is the one who will tell you who you are and what you are to be about. So that's the first panel. Armed with this, the second panel of the story is then a foray into the wilderness. You see, all identity claims have to be tested. And now this identity is tested against the world's harshest reality. Now that he has heard the cosmic blessing, how will he live that out? That's the question being posed in the text that was read. So he goes into the wilderness, and there he hears another voice. And it's a voice of seduction. He hears the voice of temptations. And it starts with, if you are the Son of God. If you are the Son of God. If you are the Son of God. If. Here is the voice of seduction. Here is the voice of power. Here is the voice of corruption. Here is the voice of the easy way. Here's the voice of confusion. But it is not the voice of identity. But because he has heard another voice, he can stand up against this lesser voice. The voice of blessing is the one who tells him who he truly is. It's the voice that helps him discern through Scripture, through his experience of the community, through his own life of prayer, through his shaping, what his purpose is and what he is about. He has been appealed to in the most seductive of ways. Make bread out of stones. Feed the people. Worship me and gain power. Test God with the fantastic. Issues that I have seen clergy fall prey to over and over and over again, and I do not preclude myself from that. And then there's the third panel of this identity triptych, and that's the return home. And he goes back to his beginnings. He goes back to his roots. He returns to the place of worship where he should be welcomed with open arms. He reads from Isaiah, the most familiar of passages. Now that he has tested his identity, now that the wrestling with the other voice has sharpened him, now with all of this, the voice still ringing from the baptismal waters dripping off of him, the voice being tested now, giving firm in his soul, now he declares his mission and listen to the very first line. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, within me. There it is. No other spirit. No seductive voice will guide me. No voice of power. No voice of ego. No voice of solely human solutions. Here is the Spirit that will guide me. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me. And here is what the Spirit is telling me to do. Announce good news to the poor. Proclaim release for those oppressed. Bring sight to the blind of all kinds. Heal the broken victims and set them free. Proclaim the year of the Lord. And all the wise heads there in the synagogue are nodding. Well done, they are thinking. Good reading, good choice of text. And then he drops the big word on them. Today. today this has come true. And if you read closely, they even like that. Until they ask him, not unlike the other voice in the wilderness, until they ask him to show us your powers. And when he told them that he couldn't because of their unbelief, he found himself then on the edge of a cliff, about to be thrown to his death. And then, and I love this, it says, he walked straight through the crowd. You don't walk through the hostile crowd without your identity well formed. You don't walk through the hostile crowd and the other voices without your identity being tested. You don't walk through those kinds of situations without a sense that God has hand on you. You don't walk through those situations without some clarity of your purpose and your mission. Identity from blessing, identity from testing, identity from declaring. And in this clarity of self, he walked through all the hostile forces there were to be about his work. Fred Craddock, a name you know, retired professor of preaching from Emory, tells a story that every preacher I know has used, and it's probably been told in this chapel a zillion times, but I'm going to tell it anyway. It comes from Craddock's days at Phillips University in Oklahoma. Originally, Craddock was from the Smoky Mountains of East Tennessee. And in the story that he tells, he and his wife have gone back to visit family, and they've driven half a day to their favorite restaurant. And while they're eating there, an old man comes up and says, "Hi, how are you folks?" "Fine," said Craddock. "But good to have you folks here. Where are you from?" "Oklahoma," said Craddock, thinking to himself, I really want to get back to my dinner. "Well, what do you do out there?" And Craddock said, I was thinking, you know, we got away from the kids. I really want to get away from this old man." But being polite, he said, "Well, I'm a preacher." "A preacher? Boy, do I have a story for you." And the old man pulled up his chair and sat down and began to tell the story of his life. He talked about the fact that he grew up in those mountains in East Tennessee, and about the fact that his mother and dad never got married, and there was that word that was used that lingered over his head, and the fact that he never knew who his father was. And he talked about the shame that came by growing up in a small town where everybody knew your business. And he talked about how he hated the things that people said and the way they would whisper about his mother and the things that kids said to him at school. He talked about how he ached to get away from that, and how he began to discover that by going out in the woods, he would find some peace and solitude. And while out in the woods, he found a small church there where he found some solace. And he said, "I would go to that church every week, and I would slip into the church after the service began and sit on the back row. And just before the service was over, I would slip out so that no one would speak to me. I loved that church, and I loved that preacher and his great big voice. And I loved the peace of that place. And I went back week after week after week. But one day I got so caught up that I forgot to get out before the service was over, and I got trapped in the aisle. And I was trying to wiggle free when I felt this hand on my shoulder, and I turned around and I was looking up into the face of that great, huge, burly preacher, and I thought he was going to eat me alive. And he said, 'Son, who are you? Who are you?' And I thought I was going to die. And the preacher said, 'Son, I know who you are.' And I was thinking, not you too. I know who you are. You're a child of God." And he turned me around and he swatted me on the seat of my pants and he said, "Son, go out and claim your inheritance." Meanwhile, back at the restaurant, Craddock turned and said, "Old man, what's your name?" He held himself erect and he said, "Ben Hooper." Craddock said, Ben Hooper. "You know, I could swear I heard my daddy tell me about a man who had twice been governor of Tennessee who was born an illegitimate baby. I could swear his name was Ben Hooper." And the old man said, "That's right. And what I just told you was the day I was born." Who are you this day? How has your identity been shaped? Where is the word of blessing in your life? Where is that word that will help you stand up to all the other voices that will come or are already there? Where has that blessing and that identity been tested? Where is it being tested even now? What is your calling, your purpose, your mission? What does it grow out of? The story of our faith is that we are children of God claimed by the voice of blessing. And that voice is with us through all the temptations that sharpen and toughen and shape us. And that ultimately that voice will guide us into our mission, which is to set free the captives and to preach good news to the poor about death and resurrection, to bind up the wounds of the broken people and the brokenhearted, to help heal the world, to declare the day of the Lord. That is our inheritance in the story of faith. That is our identity. Claim it.